The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
As time went on, you know, I've become more and more comfortable with owning my own faith and letting him have his own religious beliefs and realizing that love can be bigger than that. And you can build a marriage on more than a shared religious foundation. Was the only way to get
church uncertainty that fears everything against it. Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and we're back with the last episode of 2020. Believe it or not, it's crazy to think about that we are already here at the end of potentially the worst year of all time, at least within our lifetimes, probably. Not to say that we didn't have blessings along the way, but this has been a weird one for sure. And so probably most of us would say we're happy to see this one go and excited to see what 2021 has in store. So with that being said, we have a first-time guest on, and it's Stina Kielsmeyer-Cook. She's a writer from Minneapolis. She's also the managing editor of Bearings Online, a publication of the Collegeville Institute. And her writing has appeared in Image Journal, CT Women, Sojourners, The Other Journal, and the Christian Century. So she came on to talk about her new book, which is fantastic, highly recommended. It's called Blessed Are the Nuns, Mixed Faith Marriage, and My Search for Spiritual Community. Now, the reason I was so excited about this particular book that she wrote is that we've gotten questions that this book addresses a lot over the years. And there aren't a ton of resources out there for this particular question. And that question is, what do you do and how do you navigate the tricky situation that potentially could arise within the context of a marriage or a relationship where one or the other person is going through a spiritual deconstruction and the other one is not? And so how do you navigate that? How do you balance that, and what does that look like? And so Stina went through this herself, she and her husband. And so it's a lot of personal information and a lot of her own story. And it's very, very interesting. And I think it's super helpful, just very, very helpful. So I was excited to release this one as the last one of the year. And hopefully it is helpful to a lot of you out there who have been asking that question. So really fun chat with her. Great book. You can get it anywhere books are sold. So it's definitely widely available. With that being said, as always, just like general housekeeping stuff, you know, we have a great band on this week. And by band, I mean one person, our good friend to the podcast, Clay, provided some new music. Now, Clay hasn't come out with new music in a while. Those of you who remember his former band, he was in a band called The Undeserving, and they broke up a while ago when the whole record label fiasco occurred, and record labels were just dumping bands right and left because they were losing money. Unfortunately, Clay's band was a victim of that, but Clay still releases music as a solo artist. And he's got some really cool stuff. Some of you were lucky enough to hear some of it. Those of you who were at our live show a couple years ago in Denver got a taste of it, got to hear it live before any of it was actually recorded. So there's a handful of people out there who have heard this stuff, but it's fantastic. A lot of it follows the theme of spiritual deconstruction and kind of self-critiquing the church from the inside. Really cool tune. So there's one that we'll have featured on this episode, and then some of his older music if you're not familiar with him. But go out and support Clay. He is a starving artist. Not starving, but support him if you can. And hopefully we'll see the rest of that EP coming out here in the beginning of 2021. So excited to hear that. But other than that, if you like what we're doing, if you want to support us from a financial perspective, consider becoming part of our Patreon family. We do have a cool Patreon. We've got one of our most popular, things. What do you call them? I don't know. Incentive packages. Yeah, there you go. Is our book club, where we send you a book every month. Could be a guest that we've had on the podcast. Could be something that we're personally reading, or something that we're really interested in that we think that you might like as well. So new book every month, we ship it out to you. We've got a number of other packages on there as well. You can find that through our website, www.thedeconstructionists.com. You can find that in our show notes as well. But links to the Patreon there, links to our social media, our blog is listed there under journal, and a back catalog of all of our past episodes too. So if you want to go dig through that, you can, and you can hear our horrifying first episodes before we had a clue what we were doing. So, but be gentle. Maybe don't give us a review based off of our early episodes. Maybe wait till you get into the later ones here. But anyway, one of the biggest things you guys can do to help us get the word out, trying to get the good word out about the podcast to new people who maybe, it might be useful for them, who maybe haven't heard of us before, just telling a friend. Word of mouth is the biggest way that we've grown over the years, honestly. It's just by the kindness of people like you who are listening, who have suggested it to a friend or suggested to somebody who they thought it might be useful for. And also giving us 5-star review on iTunes helps us get exposure as well. And that's just a way to support us. That's super, super easy. So anyway, thank you guys so much for listening this year. We hope you enjoyed the guests that we had over the course of 2020. We've got a lot in store for 2021. As always, don't freak out if no new episodes come out in January. It's our usual month off where we stockpile and spend a lot of the weeks recording new material and try to get that up and running. And we'll be back in February with brand new stuff. And so we've got some really fun guests, some repeat guests, some brand new guests you've maybe not heard of or might not be familiar with. As always, we'll have a fun mixture of different guests coming on and stuff like that. So again, thank you guys so much. It is not lost on us that we are completely indebted to those of you who listen and support in whatever way that you can and that just keep listening over the years. So really appreciate it. Love all of you. And all I can say is have a great Christmas, great New Year, and stay safe and healthy, and we'll get through this to 2021. So thanks, everybody, and without further ado, I can't do the freaking in the middle. Sorry, Bob, but she has three names. What are you going to do? That's the that's the way it is. But anyway, without further ado, for our last episode of 2020, here is Stina Kielsmeyer Cook.
Taking me too long to recover.
Well, welcome to the podcast. This week we have on Stina Kielsmeyer Cook. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So this was one of those situations where, I have a relationship with a contact at your publisher, and they happen to send over a copy of your book, Blessed Are the Nuns. And, it happens to be a book that's specifically about a question that we get a lot. So I was very excited to have you on to talk about it. And it is that question of, mixed faith marriage. And what do you do specifically when you have, a partnership? You've got, a couple who are in a marriage, and one person perhaps is going through a spiritual deconstruction, maybe the other one isn't, or at the very least, they're in two different places. So I was very excited to have you on to talk about this. I think this is one of the only books I've ever seen that kind of covers the topic, and you are an excellent writer on top of that. So it's a fantastic book that I cannot recommend enough. But you're welcome. Before we get into that, though, talk a little bit about your background. Like, what kind of sort of religious upbringing do you have, and what was that like?
Yeah, well, thanks so much for saying all those nice things. It's great to be here. So my name is Dina. I'm a writer from Minneapolis. And let's see, so you're asking about the faith background?
Yeah. Did you have, were you raised in a particularly religious household, or what was that like?
Yeah, so I grew up Presbyterian, so I grew up in the mainline church. And my mother experienced a call to ordained ministry when she was in her 30s. So when I was in elementary school, she went to seminary and pursued a call and became ordained in the Presbyterian church. So I grew up in that kind of mainline Protestant sort of world. And I also went to evangelical Bible camp every summer. So that was kind of where I... Yeah, that's kind of where I would have my my kind of on fire for Jesus sort of experiences was every summer going for a week or two to the North Woods in Wisconsin and, you know, canoeing and backpacking and having kind of an on fire experience there. And so the camp was affiliated with Wheaton College in the Chicago area, which is famous for Billy Graham and very conservative kind of other social figures, but also was a place, just a great, I don't know, intellectual exploration, exposed me to different streams within the Christian tradition as well as the evangelical tradition. And so I went to evangelical college, and that's where I met my now husband, Josh. He grew up in a Southern Baptist kind of setting as a missionary kid in South America. And so when we were in college, we were kind of discovering things like liturgy for the first time, attending the local Anglican church. And after we got married, we kind of hopped around a little bit to different denominations. We went to an Episcopalian church for a while, and then we were volunteers in an intentional Christian community that had a lot of Mennonite members. And so we were really attracted to the simplicity and emphasis on service. And so in our neighborhood in Minneapolis, there was a tiny little Mennonite church that was really focused on service, loving your neighbors, and that kind of thing. And so that's where we ended up going to church before my husband eventually deconverted and walked away from Christianity altogether. So yeah, we've had a kind of a mixture of different streams of Christianity that have influenced us. And then on my own, since my husband's deconversion, have been really interested in exploring the Catholic tradition and specifically Salesian spirituality, which is the spirituality that comes out of the visitation order of a monastic community.
Oh, that's so interesting. And one of the things that I think is most fascinating about your particular spiritual journey is the fact that most people, when they're kind of church hopping or trying to find a new church home, kind of tend to stay within their lane in terms of like, you know, I was born and raised Methodist. I'm going to try to find a local Methodist church. And that seems very, very kind of brave because a lot of those churches are very different just in terms of the way that they structure even their services. So what was it in particular? Did you have certain criteria that you were looking for in a church and were just kind of like, we don't care what the background is so long as it meets these certain types of criteria?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it kind of depends on which era, or, you know, I think there's different criteria at different times, but I think in college it was more like, oh, realizing that there's a historical tradition in which, you know, this certain form of Christianity that we were raised in comes out of. So being that more interested in, you know, things like liturgy and what prayers have been prayed for centuries and understanding ancient practices from the tradition that we come from. And then I think also with like the Mennonite tradition, being really interested and attracted to people who are really tangibly living out their faith, like their lives look differently because of how they are following Jesus. So things like simplicity and nonviolence and that kind of thing. And then in terms of the Catholic tradition, that was more, I work for an organization that's an ecumenical center. So it naturally brings together people from different theological and denominational backgrounds. And so I was already getting exposed to a lot of new people in and through that just job. And it is based at St. John's Abbey, which is one of the largest Benedictine monastic communities in North America. And so that too was just a new thing for me to explore, of just understanding, okay, all Christians can trace back to one of their sources is this Benedictine monastic kind of rhythm that predates, you know, the Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholic and obviously the Protestant Reformation. All of these schisms, we can all go back to some of the early church practices and say, this is our common inheritance. This is something that we all share. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of different reasons for wanting to sample or understand, you know, faith in and through these different lenses.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I remember a time when I was kind of exploring Catholicism a little, and for the first time when I realized that there are a lot of different branches of Catholicism, you know, the Benedictines, the Franciscans, and, you know, the Ignatians, and all these different schools of thought that I did not know existed. I just thought, you know, Catholic is a Catholic is a Catholic.
Right.
Not true.
Yes, no, there's an incredible diversity. Yeah, an incredible diversity in through the Catholic tradition as well. Yes.
Yeah, so one of the main themes, obviously, in the book is, you know, the thing that prompted the whole thing in general is the deconversion, you know, that you said that your husband went through, Josh. Was there, looking back, was there a moment that kind of sparked that for him, or was it just kind of a gradual process of asking questions and examining the things that he had been raised to believe?
Yeah, you know, I think it was more of a gradual thing for him. He, you know, I try not to go too much into his story in the book because it is his story. And, you know, when we were talking about, okay, could I write a book about our marriage? How would this look? I was really intentional about trying not to step in and speak for him and his experience because it is his story and it is his process. And so that's why I tend to focus more on my own spiritual journey in how, you know, navigating my side of an interfaith marriage looks. But yeah, I think for him, he grew up in a missionary family and attended Christian schools his whole life. And so I think once we graduated from college and he went to graduate school, he's a scientist. So he was in a master's program and just becoming friends with people who are outside of a very insular world. I think that that was a big part of his deconstruction process. And then as someone who was raised with more biblical literalism and, you know, this kind of emphasis on if you believe, you know, these black and white kind of ways of understanding scripture, then that's what it means to be a Christian. And I think when you get to a place where you're saying, well, I'm not so sure about this, or I don't know about this part of it, right belief was hammered down as being so much more of what it meant to be a Christian versus belonging to a specific community or being part of a certain or doing certain practices where, you know, other traditions might have an emphasis on another kind of piece of what it means to belong to a faith community. I think when the belief part wasn't there, you know, that made it so that he's like, I can't pretend anymore that this is resonating or this is what I think is true about the world. So he might tell it differently. I don't know. I'll have to ask him. But I think it was some combination of that.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the book too. You talk a little bit about the, you know, him recounting. Yeah, I believe it was a conversation that you were having in the kitchen where he talks about the moment where he stopped believing, being almost came with almost a sense of relief because of all of the fear that his faith was kind of based in too. And that must have been an immense amount of pressure, especially growing up as a kid in that kind of environment.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, I think there's a combination of, you know, the certain environment that he was raised in, but also his personality and how he reacted and responded to the theology. Whereas, you know, other members of his family had a very different response to it. So yeah, I think for him though, it was a very oppressive, feeling and a feeling of being afraid and feeling of always never measuring up and never being good enough. So when he talked about, you know, shedding that notion of a God that was always kind of, you know, I don't know, maybe out to get you or never thinking that you were enough. You know, when he kind of described those feelings or that orientation towards faith, I was like, yeah, I don't really believe in that God either. I think that my spirituality in the mainline church, you know, did talk about sin and about judgment, but it was much more focused on God's love and mercy and grace. And so I don't know, I'm not sure if it was a combination of, you know, that specific theology and his personality or what have you. But I think, you know, we all have to kind of look back at the stories that we were told and, you know, with as grown-ups, as adults, and try to sort through, you know, what was it that I was being told about who God is, and what parts did I latch onto, and for what reasons? And I think it's really complicated, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I think once you throw kids into the mix, and you're faced with the prospect of having to raise children, you know, you start to have those very serious conversations about how was it related to us as children, and how do we want to convey those messages and those stories to our children? And it takes on a whole new complicated, you know, element, you know, to the situation.
Definitely. Yes.
So one of the biggest things that I'm always interested in, because I went through a similar experience myself while I was still married, I was kind of going through my own kind of deconstruction. Now, I probably came out slightly differently than Josh did, perhaps, but there was a moment where, you know, I was standing in the kitchen. I remember talking to my then wife, and I said, you know, I don't know what I believe right now, but I was adamant that I was going to research it to death and figure it out, you know, which is absurd, but that was my approach. But I just remember her reaction and kind of, and of course, there's a lot of it I didn't know at the time that she kind of conveyed to me later. But speaking from the person who still had, you know, this sense of faith, the sense of belief, that must have been a large amount of pressure on you. And, you know, you've got someone that you love dearly, the person who's arguably the closest to you in the world, who suddenly just says, I don't believe anymore. So how did that impact your life of faith?
Yeah, well, that is so much of what the story is about. I think for so long in our tradition, especially in the evangelical college we attended, I think I kind of absorbed, I don't know if it was secondhand or if they were overt messages, but where marriage was, you know, you could only have a successful marriage if it was based in a mutual faith in God. You know, that was just hammered down over and over. And so I think when Josh said he no longer believed, I suddenly was thought of those messages and thought, okay, well, what does that mean? Does that mean that we can no longer have a healthy marriage? And so I went looking at books, you know, because there are some books out there about, you know, unequally yoked yes. couples, which I, you know, really dislike that term, but, you know, it's a biblical term. And so, you know, what does it mean if your partner is not a believer? And so there are resources and books out there, but I think I too was kind of in the middle of my own deconstruction. I never got to the place where my husband did, where I said, you know, I'm done with this and I'm walking away. You know, I was holding on by my fingernails. And so I couldn't really find a resource or a book or story that kind of show that same kind of journey, I guess. And so for me, yeah, it really forced me to examine what I believe, because, you know, if my husband no longer believes, it would be a lot easier if we were both in the same place. You know, it would be a lot easier if we were both deciding, okay, we're just done with church, we're going to figure something else out together. But if I was going to choose to stay in the faith, then how could I define that for myself? What would that look like? What does it mean to practice your faith on your own? And how do you own that for yourself? And I think in a lot of ways, I had had this kind of unhealthy sort of codependent sort of understanding of faith. It's not that we had like a headship theology or anything like that, but more like, you know, our spiritual lives depend on one another. Like it was much more of that kind of understanding. And I think my journey has been one of realizing that I think in any relationship, even if you do share a religious tradition, you're never going to be in completely the same place, you know, or there might be times when you're not in step with one another about what you believe. And so I think that this notion that, well, if you just believe in the same things, then everything will be okay is actually really misleading. And we all have to do our own work of owning our spirituality and our spiritual practices. And so that's what it really forced me to do, was to kind of examine what is it that I believe, and then how do I find the support and community that I need to nurture the faith that I do have, while also loving and respecting and holding sacred the things that my husband holds to be true. So it's definitely been hard, because there's not like a natural place for couples who are interfaith in a traditional like church environment. And so finding places where we could belong together was definitely the hardest part of this whole thing.
Tell me what you want. 'cause I don't know who to be. And I never thought we'd ever see a battle we can't be. And I don't know who you are.
Yeah, and I love that part of the book too, because you guys come up with a very creative way, I think, to handle that problem. But before we get into that, I think what's an interesting, unique part of the story, and you kind of referenced this earlier, is that you worked in a place where you're literally surrounded by religious people while you're kind of going through trying to juggle like how to deal with your husband's deconversion and your own kind of spiritual journey / deconstruction at the same time. And so a large part of this are these nuns that play this huge role in kind of almost like... Yeah. Giving you spiritual guidance and stuff. And the funny thing to me throughout the book is, at least it seemed this way when I was reading it, the nuns seemed very unfazed by all of this. They're just like, oh, yeah, it's fine.
Totally.
So, yeah, talk about the role of the nuns, because they sound amazing, by the way, in the book.
Yeah, no, they are. They're incredible people. And they're people, you know, they're not like saints. And I think that that's important to acknowledge, too. They're mm-hmm. people who've committed to live their lives in a very unique way. But they're just as human as the rest of us, and wonderful, wonderful friends and spiritual companions. But yeah, that definitely was my initial attraction, to getting to know monastic people, beyond having flirted with the whole new monasticism movement, you know, back in my post-college years. I was just really interested in the fact that they seemed to not be afraid of engaging with religious outsiders or people who were agnostic or atheist. They didn't seem to have the same urgency. And maybe it's because I, you know, was formed in evangelical institutions that really put that onus on, you know, it's your job to share the gospel with others, and that real sense of, oh, I've got to do this thing. If I am going to show love to my neighbor, I need to share this information with them so that they don't go to hell. Realizing that there was actually a very different way of showing and sharing love and sharing God's goodness. That looked really differently and didn't kind of traffic in some of the same fear that I had felt in some of these other religious institutions. So that was the initial attraction, was, you know, going to some religious events with Josh, feeling like, oh man, who is he going to talk to? And realizing that some of the nuns in the Benedictine community were some of the easiest people to talk to and totally unfazed by... you know, where he was at in his, you know, faith understanding or faith journey. And I think that there is something about the steadiness and stability of some of these practices and communities that have withstood time, and maybe it's also that these are older women for the most part who have seen a lot in their lives, that it's kind of, there's just a deep abiding trust that, yes, okay, you may be in this place and who knows where you'll end up, but I can still trust in God's goodness, and my job is just to love you as you are, which was a really healing attitude for me to kind of absorb and learn from.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And one of the other interesting things, I think, too, is that this seems rather uncommon these days with a lot of folks that we encounter who maybe didn't start out in like more of the evangelical, non-denominational style Christianity, but maybe ended up there for a time and then sort of found their way back to, you know, what you might call like the high church or the traditional church, and seeking some of that ancient wisdom, and finding a home there, which you would think would be the opposite direction, but it seems to be quite prevalent these days.
Yeah, I think that, you know, maybe some of that ahistoricalness of being part of a non-denominational church or environment, or just, you know, we just read the Bible and do what it says, realizing, well, there's a lot of ways that you could read this. And why do we look at it this way? Or why do we understand it in this context? And I think as those questions pop up, and the Bible is not an easy document to read, it's not an easy text to understand, what does it mean to live out, you know, what Jesus says in the Gospels? There's a lot of different ways communities have interpreted that over time. And so I do think there is a just desire for connection and understanding of, you know, even as our society has changed, there are some enduring truths that are here that community and tradition have interpreted. And maybe I don't have to completely filter this through my own individual self or my own little church community, maybe there's some other resources and wisdom to draw on. And I think that that is comforting. I mean, we're living in a pandemic right now, and you read about some of the mystics and some of the, you know, the saints who were writing during times of great plague and who lived through horrible things. And you realize, you know, none of this is new. And there's something that feels really solid about that. And you don't feel quite as detached maybe from a tradition and a God that has been constant throughout all these ages.
Yeah. And it seems like there's no secret as to why certain figures and authors, thinkers right now are so widely popular. Like there's no reason in the world that a 75-year-old Franciscan monk who lives out in the middle of, you know, New Mexico should be so popular, but yet, you know, you listen, you know who I'm talking about. Papa yeah. Roar. But like yes. so popular right now among such a young generation and, or like, for example, Pope Francis, who's widely the most popular Pope, you know, arguably in a long time, you know, and it's these guys who are in this steeped in this very, very, old tradition. And it's not like, you know, somebody that's part of like a new movement.
Right, right. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. And I think that that was something, as, you know, someone who was attracted to the new monasticism movement and still have friends who are part of that movement and respect, you know, what Protestants have, you know, the attraction and the pull, but realizing that there's a whole other tradition that has continued. And, you know, I don't think hierarchy and patriarchy and some of these things that are baked into certain monastic structures are the healthiest of things, but there are certain wisdoms that you can find in things like the Rule of Saint Benedict that talk about, you know, how do you govern community life? You know, you don't have to completely start over from scratch every time a group of people who want to follow Jesus want to live more intentionally or want to follow the teachings of Jesus. There's a lot else that is already out there. So I think that that was just really exciting. And I think too, when you become disillusioned with the faith tradition that you grew up with, for whatever reason, I think it is helpful sometimes to turn to a different strand within the same kind of general stream. That's a mixed metaphor, but you know what I mean? Like turn to a different expression of the Christian faith that can maybe help you look at some of these fundamental truths in a new light or have a new, yeah, cast a new light on them that can help you continue and persevere in times when it feels like, you know, why am I still here? Why am I still doing this? Does this make sense anymore? And I think that those are real questions that a lot of my peers from my college too, in the years since we all graduated, have been grappling with. And it's been interesting just to see different, you know, the different trajectories people take.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Yeah. It's funny. I would even argue, I'm like, one of the things that I've started doing is reading Jewish commentary on the Old Testament. I'm like, why wouldn't you? They wrote it, refreshing just to get a different perspective and see things maybe in the verses that I've read a million times that I never saw before reading, rabbinical, literature. Totally agree. But one of the things in the book that I really liked, because I think there's a lot of power in naming something, and you came up with this term that you call spiritual singleness, and it really put a name to something that I had experienced. So talk about what you mean by that.
Yeah, so it's funny, because it's kind of this mystical experience in the book early on where I'm kind of having a monologue or talking to God. I'm not really sure if God's there, and I just have this phrase sort of deposited in my brain. I'm not sure if it's from the Holy Spirit or if it's just my subconscious coming up with something, remixing something from down below and popping it into my brain. But yeah, it was naming something that I think, even though I was, in a marriage that was a good one, where we supported each other, loved one another very much, parenting two little kids, realizing that I felt alone, in trying to figure out what it means to follow Jesus when I can't share that with my partner. And I think a lot of churches are just set up for a nuclear family. The programming is kind of geared that way. When you kind of try to navigate that awkward fellowship hour service, it can feel uncomfortable, trying to be in that space if you are the only person in your marriage, the only partner there with your two little kids. And so I just was feeling very alone in that way. I think also too, because I was in a new church, so I didn't have a whole lot of pre-existing relationships to kind of fall back on. So I hear this term and I think, I wonder if this is part of my attraction to monastic communities as well, because these are people who take a vow of celibacy. They're intentionally choosing a lifestyle that doesn't include, a marriage partner or kids. And even though that isn't my life, maybe there was some kind of special kinship that I had to nuns or to female saints, most of whom were not married, who were living their lives for God without a partner. So that was kind of the initial draw and attraction to the term. And it doesn't really pan out the way I think it is, but it does take me to the monastery. It prompts me to keep going back to join this spiritual formation group that meets at the monastic community over the course of a year to learn a little bit more about the order, Salesian spirituality, and the two saints that founded the order. So yeah, I'm curious to hear a little bit about your interest in that term or what you thought of when you read about it.
Yeah, I think the first thing that comes to mind is the singleness part of it is just the solitude of being the one person who is kind of carrying the load. And like I directly connected it to being the one there with kids or a child at least, and having to kind of carry that on your own. I just thought that was so interesting. And I can only imagine like trying to start over in a new church community and having to bear the weight of that while still like connecting with a new community and meeting new people and forging new relationships.
Yeah, I think there is a particular kind of loneliness. And I think, single people in the church have been saying this, divorced people, people who come outside of any kind of traditional nuclear family have been saying this for a long time, that churches can often be really lonely places. And one of the sisters that I get to know in the story, she had been a Baptist missionary in Asia for like 30 years before she became a Catholic nun. She's got a really interesting story. But she told me about, going to the Baptist churches in her home state of Texas and being put in groups called spares and pairs, where she was essentially compared to like a spare part,
Yeah.
And I think there really is that feeling of like, well, I don't quite fit here. Like, this isn't really made for me. Where you realize when you look at, you look at Paul, you look at some of the gospel writings about singleness, and you realize actually the nuclear family isn't really all that biblical in the way that it's, written and in the stories that are in the Bible. And so, why do our places of worship feel so alienating for people who are not there with a partner who shares the same faith as them or who are single. So yeah, there can be a particular kind of loneliness in that, in trying to find community.
Yeah, I feel like somebody missed an opportunity there to create a t-shirt that, like, third wheel for the Lord or something like that, you know. But
definitely.
Yeah, and I think probably I partially connected with that term also because I can identify from the divorce angle of, you know, like attending your child's, like, school functions as a single parent, you know, and like all the other couples, you know, both parents are there and you're just kind of like, okay, you know, I'm here by myself.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. We churches by and large are not equipped to really handle those things in a healthy, helpful way, I should say.
Right. Or it's more like, we need to fix this for you. We need to find somebody. Yeah. It's a problem that needs to be fixed. And that was also the case with a lot of the unequally yoked books that I read, where it really was like, let's try to pray our partner back to faith. And there's nothing wrong with praying for your partner. Like, I'm all for that. But I think it does kind of give you this attitude of, okay, well, this is wrong. It needs to be right. Like, they're, you know, this is inherently bad that you are in an interfaith relationship, and this is how it fixes. It could get fixed. And of course, I think there's a lot of things that are easier about sharing a religious tradition with your partner. And I don't want to minimize the challenge and the struggle that can be there when you are not in the same place spiritually. But I don't think it's helpful to have that kind of lens where it's like, okay, it's on you now to be a missionary in your own home, you know, and to fix this problem, because that's not respectful, I don't think.
Yeah, keep going with that line of thought, because I think there's got to be a lot of pressure on somebody like your husband, who is probably surrounded by people who are believers, and so there's a lot of pressure to kind of conform to that, and probably a lot of pressure around him. Just, you know, even in thinking, I'm sure he thought about it long before he uttered the words. And you even talk about a story at the very, very beginning of the book where he's having a heated conversation, we'll say, with his dad. And so there's pressure coming from a lot of different angles, I guess, is what I'm getting at. So talk a little bit about that, and then talk about, like, you know, how supportive was your community in terms of his kind of transition to this non-belief, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. I mean, when you come from a really religious family and community, if you're the one who's suddenly making a break, you know, that's just hard on everyone. And so I have empathy for everyone. And especially though, for my husband, I'm his wife. I'm here to look out for him and his well-being. And so I just saw how much he struggled, in doing this thing that he felt was, you know, the truest thing that he could be doing in terms of being honest about, this is where I'm at. This is what I believe. This is no longer working for me. And I think it took a lot of bravery and courage. I think there's a lot of people who are not always honest with themselves about where they're at, with their faith. And it was a risk, you know? And so I think the fact that he, you know, trusted me enough to be honest and trusted his family enough to be honest was something that I really respect and, you know, honor in his journey. And yes, it's been hard for his family. I think it's been hard for me, but I think when I sit back and look at, you know, the integrity that he displayed in being truthful, and recognizing, you know, that this wasn't something that was, a force for good in his life, then it helps me to respect it and to honor that's, you know, his experience. And you can't negotiate someone else's experience, even if it's different than yours. Right. And so, yeah, I think, you know, but even as I say that, like, there's still grief, right? There's still times where you're like, oh, well, this is what I expected this to be. And so I think also making space for, you know, my own emotions around this, of being like, yeah, I didn't think that this is what my marriage was going to be like. And that's hard. And those feelings and emotions are also valid. So, I mean, counseling has been really good for us. And, you know, time has been really good for us. You know, this is now, I think it's like 6 or 7 years ago now that he had this experience. I don't think I could have written a book like this in those first years, because it took a while, you know, to kind of shake out, well, what is this going to mean for us, and how are we going to do this? And I think too, for our faith community at the time, it was kind of more of a, you know, not something you just like go and broadcast, right? Like, I'm going to go stand up in front of the service and be like, by the way, Josh is not a Christian anymore. You know, so I kind of open up the book with, you know, talking about some of those conversations that you have when people are asking, so where is your spouse today? You know, like,
right.
You know, right. Especially in those first months. And it's awkward. You're like, he's at home. You know, you make excuses. And then at some point it's like, yeah, he isn't feeling it anymore. This isn't really where he wants to be. And, you know, everyone in our Mennonite church and in the American Baptist church have been wonderful. Like, I have never gotten, you know, a hurtful or negative comment or anything like that. But it's more just people don't really know what to do with that information.
Right.
And so that's the part that's hard, is that it just doesn't quite feel comfortable because you're not fitting the narrative, you know, that is kind of assumed.
Are you? To think that love was tragic, that's when you came running through my door. It wasn't fate, it wasn't magic.
Yeah, and I remember you talk about in the book kind of that formulaic idea of how life is supposed to go. You know, you're supposed to find a Christian spouse, you know, you're supposed to not have sex before marriage. You're supposed to, you know, do all these things, go to Bible study and all this stuff. And you're right. It doesn't quite fit that narrative, does it?
No. And I think most people will tell you that it doesn't fit that narrative. And so that, you know, we are all kind of dealing with the disillusionment, I think, of midlife, or like things kind of turning out differently than maybe we had thought. And so I think too, like the story, I don't know, I'm hoping that it can relate to people in any kind of stage of trying to figure out, well, now what do I do? Like, this is what I thought. Now what does my life look like, or how do I live faithfully?
Yeah. So talk a little, do you recall your reaction when he first kind of had that conversation with you? Cause I can recall having that conversation with my ex-wife, and I remember she said for months after that, she would secretly pray for me that I would kind of, you know, do an about face. And then eventually throughout the process, you know, this podcast was birthed out of conversations with my, one of my dear friends who happened to be, my pastor at the time, ironically. And, for me, it became a situation where for the first time in my life, I took ownership over what I actually believed and actually sat down and say, all right, what do I believe and why do I believe these things? And I'd never done any of the work myself, you know? So I'm like, I wouldn't treat anything else in my life that's this important in this way. Like, I do more research on, you know, the card that I'm going to buy, as Rohr says, I think in one of his books, or somebody, I'm getting mixed up, but, but like, you know what I mean? It's like you do more research on other things than you do oftentimes on your belief system. You just kind of, as my buddy Adam used to say, belief by proxy. You just kind of, you know, take it for granted that people are just giving you the answers and without questioning them. And so like, do you remember your reaction like when he first said that, and kind of what your response was?
Yeah, well, so, you know, I think I had said that, you know, we were both kind of in a place of like not being totally sure where we were at. And so I thought, you know, he was exploring some other faith traditions and reading different books on, you know, Sufism. I don't know, he was reading widely. And I just was like, okay, we're still going to the church, but I've got questions too that I don't know how to answer. But then I think it was when he, you know, told his dad that he wasn't a Christian anymore. And, you know, hearing his dad's response and being like, well, you know, having a response to that of, well, we need, you know, what does that mean? I think that made it suddenly the public, you know, whereas before it was like a conversation, you know, or like we're talking about our doubts and yet we're still, you know, participating in the life of a faith community. And so, yeah, when he said that, I just was, I don't know. I think I had to deal with it for the first time because it wasn't just a conversation between us. It was other people were, you know, were hearing about it. And, you know, he's like, I don't want to go to church anymore. And I don't want, you know, to dedicate our second born. And, you know, some of the things, those practices that we had been doing with our first child. So that felt like the big kind of line in the sand. And at that point, yeah, I mean, it's hard to remember, but I wrote a lot. I mean, that's a lot of how I process things. Of just like, okay, well now what? And feeling grief, feeling disconnection, feeling loss, mourning, you know, what I had imagined life to be. I'm a big idealist. And so, you know, just trying to sort through, okay, now what? And it took a while, you know, we were kind of hanging in there when we had little kids too. So it's already just a stressful time, you know, to be navigating any marriage, I think, is when you've got little babies around and you're sleep deprived.
Yeah.
But
absolutely,
you know, for whatever reason, I just felt the strong compulsion just to keep going to church. Like I wasn't doing a whole lot of like scripture reading or any other kind of spiritual practices, but I just really relied on my little congregation. And it, you know, it wasn't that like the sermons were necessarily knocking it out of the park or anything, but it was just the quiet, faithful witness of the people who would show up every week. And it was just really a community that was supportive and loving and kind. And so, yeah, I guess I can't really remember more than just that it was a time when I felt a lot of grief and we struggled. But it, you know, we hung in there, and I don't know, just maybe it's that stubborn persistence. And gradually, as time went on, you know, I've become more and more comfortable with owning my own faith and letting him have his own religious beliefs and realizing that love can be bigger than that. And you can build a marriage on more than a shared religious foundation.
Yeah, that's a huge revelation. Before we move on, because I have another question about that, actually. But talk a little bit about, because I think the children aspect of it is such a huge thing to navigate or to try to figure out, especially when, because, you know, there's plenty of, I think there's a lot of literature probably out there in terms of like, you know, if I'm Christian and I marry a Jew, like how do you raise your kids Jewish or do you raise them Christian? Like there's stuff like that, but like there's probably not a lot out there that talks about what do you do if one of you is a believer and one of you is not. So like, was that a conscious conversation that you and your husband sat down and said, well, I'd like to still kind of raise our kids? Cause you do talk about like Advent, I think is kind of one of the instances mm-hmm. where you kind of brought forth some traditions and the kids were kind of like, oh, okay. You know, so talk about that. What was that process? What did that look like?
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of an ongoing conversation. I wouldn't say that we've like definitively decided, you know, this is how it's going to be. But yeah, early on, I want to take our kids to church. I want them to know what it means to be part of a faith community. And of course, they're gonna know that their dad isn't there, and they're gonna know that their dad doesn't believe the same things. But I want to at least give them the opportunity to experience the same tradition and to be part of that community and to learn about the Bible and all that kind of stuff. And so Josh has been supportive of that, which has really been helpful. I think it would have been a lot harder if he was, you know, felt more strongly about them not attending services or something like that. But, you know, there have been times where what about vacation Bible school? You know, like, is that okay? Or what about, you know, camp? Like I said earlier on, like I had a lot of my spiritual formation at some of these more traditional evangelical Bible camp kind of experiences. And, you know, I think he feels more uncomfortable with that. So our kids are still young enough that we haven't really gotten to that age, at least for like sleepaway camp. So we haven't, you know, had to cross that bridge, I guess. But it's kind of on a case-by-case basis. So things like vacation Bible school, you know, I'll talk to the children's pastor and say, okay, so tell me, you know, tell me what's going on here this week. What are we talking about? And it's like, okay, we're talking about the fruits of the Spirit. You know, we're going to memorize some verses about that. And it's games and, you know, verses. Yeah. We're going to talk about nailing our sins to a cross and, you know, burning our sins on paper like I did as a kid. You know,
right.
That there's different gradients, I guess, of Christian education. And so so it's been important to both of us that we kind of feel out what is it that our kids are learning, and then, you know, what do we feel comfortable with together. So we've been able to kind of navigate that on a case-by-case basis. But I don't have any worry that our kids are not going to know that there's alternatives, right, to Christianity, because that's the reality of our home. And so I hope that through how we're able to love and respect one another and respect each other's different faves or lack thereof, that hopefully that communicates and, you know, a healthy environment, and one that hopefully reflects the good parts about what it means to be a Christian too on my end. Because there's also fear. If I'm, you know, being honest, there's times when I'm wondering, you know, are they getting the right foundation? Are they understanding, you know, the faith in the way that I did growing up in a family that had, you know, a mom and a dad that were both part of the same tradition? It is going to be different for them. But I think that that is the big movement that I'm hoping the book communicates, and that I have journeyed, is moving from a place of fear to a place of trust and a place of, you know, really resting in God's goodness and being, you know, being content to stay in that place versus grasping and trying to control and trying to, you know, navigate things in a way that would be hurtful to my agnostic husband. Because ultimately, I don't think that that's going to be a message or example that the kids would see as being exactly Christ-like or loving. So we'll see. I'm not sure how it's all going to go. We'll see when they get to be bigger, you know, what their experiences of being in an interfaith family look like. But you're right, there really aren't a lot of good resources out there. And so, you know, I think that that's something that I'm, you know, I think about writing in the future. It's like, well, what would an interfaith family advent guide look like that would be more open and inclusive to someone who's agnostic? Like, are there different traditions or ways of marking these seasons that can, you know, give a nod to someone who maybe isn't comfortable or isn't part of that religious tradition? So I think there's a lot of space to create new ways of doing some of the same church calendary things that, you know, I find life-giving.
Yeah, and one of the things I think that you share in common, there was a couple who Adam and I met some years ago at a live event that we did out in Denver, Colorado, and the husband, I think, had kind of started down this path of deconstruction or spiritual journey first, and the wife was there, and somebody, there was another younger couple there that asked them, well, what was the key to getting through this? And I just remember her saying, like, she just supported him. You know, she didn't get it necessarily. She wasn't in the same place, but she supported him and said, hey, if you want to go to this Rob Bell event, go. You just go. And then she started to go with him. And I think, and that's kind of what I see with your story, is that, you know, you didn't necessarily shame Josh for believing what he believed, but there was this mutual support that seems to exist on both ends, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think that that's really fundamental, is, you know, really having that deep respect for the other person's autonomy, you know? Like, I think sometimes we build up marriage as being this be-all, end-all, and I think, you know, we need solid friendships outside of our marriage. We need faith communities. We need all different kinds of communities to support us, and we can't get all of our needs met in any one person. And so I think if that is really the way you view marriage, is that, okay, this is my soulmate person who's going to meet all my needs, and suddenly we don't believe the same things, then yeah, it does feel like everything falls apart, because you're not getting that need met somewhere else. And I think it's healthier though to recognize that, you know, in any kind of relationship, there's going to be times when you're in it, you're feeling that connection. There's times when you're not. And of course there has to be enough connection outside of, you know, for it to be a healthy relationship, just period. Other things that you share if you don't share a faith. But yeah, I think that, you know, we don't have to be as afraid, I guess, of it shaking the relationship apart if suddenly our partner has some different, you know, takes a different journey than maybe we've been on. But I think, you know, there's also lines that can get crossed. You know, I've talked to other couples where, you know, sometimes those divisions get to be to a point where there's no coming back. You know, sometimes things change too much or too fast, and there isn't that mutual respect, or there's, you know, they're just, I want to acknowledge and name that sometimes it doesn't work out. And I think that that's also part of what can be hard and scary about this journey, right, of navigating faith difference in marriage. So it really, I think, depends a lot on that particular couple and how they're communicating and how, how they're journeying together through it, because we needed a lot of counseling. You know, we needed a lot of help to be able to do this. And it isn't easy sometimes, you know? So I don't want to paint it with a rosy, like, this is just the best, because it's hard. It's hard when you're suddenly up against, you know, how are we doing Sunday mornings, or how are we going to have this hard conversation about vacation Bible school, or how do we understand, like, what we value together? So I think it really does help when you can find other couples or identify with other stories, which is why I wrote the book, because it gives you a sense of, okay, there are ways that this can be done, and it can be a really beautiful thing.
Yeah, one of the important things I think you just mentioned is this idea that it's kind of like a grieving process. You're grieving the death of this life that you thought that you were going to live, or like this version of your life that you thought you were going to live. And so, like, one of the things I thought was really interesting and useful is where you talk about this idea of the power of relinquishment and how that was very helpful. And so, and of course, it reminds me, because I think you even quote Rohr in there, where he talks about this idea of the death and rebirth. And in this case, you know, the death of the life you envisioned, in a sense. So talk about how powerful and healing relinquishment can be.
Yeah, I mean, you named it. It's scary, and it's hard to let go of what we had dreamed, or what we thought God was telling us, you know, was going to happen. I think that there's also that element to it. You know, we really, when we got married, you know, all of our guests were like, we saw the Holy Spirit doves in the clouds above your outdoor wedding ceremony. You know, it felt like we had all this outside confirmation. And so it's like, well, then what is my relationship to God now? Like, I feel like I had this idea or vision that I thought was from God. Now it's different, or now it's not the way I thought it was. What, you know, how do I then process that disillusionment, right, with God, with my partner? And I think that is part of just getting older and being in more of like midlife, is just you have to let go of some of these ideas or ways of being that you thought life were going to be, because if you keep holding on to them, they just distort, right? Because they're no longer true, right? They're no longer the reality that you're in. And if you don't let go of them, there's no space for something new to come and be born. And I saw that a lot in the sisters as well. You know, a lot of their monastic communities are contracting. If you look at how many sisters were joining monastic communities in the 1950s and 60s, pre-Vatican II, versus today, it's, you know, an enormous contraction. And so a whole way of life is really dying out in certain areas. And I just see this phenomenal trust and faithfulness in continuing the lifestyle, the monastic lifestyle, continuing in acts of service, continuing to trust in God's goodness, that, yeah, maybe the form of the church that existed at one time is no longer going to be the way it is now. It doesn't mean that God isn't still good. It doesn't mean God still isn't working. But it takes a lot of trust, right, to be able to let go of things that are no longer alive in the way that they maybe once were. And realizing that maybe that is just the way of things, right? Maybe, I think Parker Palmer talks about disillusionment, you know, like God being the great iconoclast, you know, smashing idols left and right, taking down these ideas of what we as humans kind of build up as being what should be, versus what it is in reality. And it's painful. It's a painful thing. But in my own story, I don't think I would be able to be in a place of trust and a place where I can affirm God's goodness if I wasn't able to let go of that vision. Because otherwise, I'd just be living the story of just reacting to what Josh's decision was 7 years ago versus being part of rebuilding and coming up with a new way for our family to function in the world, which I think is much more about redemption and about serving and loving our neighbor. So, I think that learning to trust the dying, as Richard Rohr says, is something that we'll probably have to keep doing in life, and it's not easy.
Yeah. Oh, man. So a couple ideas I want to end on that I thought were really cool. And so talk about them. And so maybe start with the nuns and nuns and N-U-N-S and N-O-N-E-S, the nuns and nuns first. Yes. And then maybe talk about this thing that you started, your Interfaith Supper Club after that.
Yeah. Well, Nuns and Nuns is a great community that's actually nationwide. So depending on where you live, there's probably a Nuns and Nuns chapter in your community. You can go to nunsandnuns.org and kind of look up where they exist. But they are these just basically small groups, intergenerational small groups between mostly millennials and monastic sisters in most cases. And they kind of were born after the 2016 election, actually, where a lot of young spiritually disaffiliated people who were interested in activism, in resistance, in kind of figuring out a way to engage with the political system, were looking to Catholic sisters who often are on the front lines of a lot of social movements when you look at different protest movements that are out there, and wondering, is there, you know, how have you been able to sustain this rhythm of engaging the world when, you know, 10 times out of 10, it seems like justice is not being served, or the greater arc towards moral goodness is just lying flat? And how do you continue to, resource that kind of work? And so they started having conversations. This was kind of, I think this was at Harvard University that the first group started to meet and talk. And they realized that there was just all these great kind of synergies that would come in and through their conversation. One of the taglines is, surprise, we're soulmates. Like, we find that there's something that this younger generation of activists and this older generation of contemplatives in a true mutuality. So I learned about this movement while I was writing the book and thought, oh my gosh, this has been my experience. I'm not an activist per se, but I am someone who has really been attracted to both the contemplative and the prophetic nature of monastic communities. And so I thought it would be great to have something like this in my area. So in and through my relationship with the Visitation Sisters in my neighborhood, we started a group of nuns and nuns. So we still meet once a month. We're meeting over Zoom now. But we get together and we talk about different spiritual practices. And we have a mix of people who are religiously affiliated or non-affiliated, but it's a space where, you know, there's no kind of assumption that you have to believe any one thing in order to be in conversation. So everyone there is a seeker to some degree, although the Catholic sisters are obviously professed religious members of communities, but they also share in having questions and doubts. And so it's just been a really wonderful place, I think, for me, even though it's not a place that Josh and I share together. It's been a good place for me just to have conversations about my own faith and owning my own path. We'll check out Nuns and Nuns. They're awesome. And then you asked about Interfaith Supper Club. So Interfaith Supper Club kind of came out of this desire for finding a community where we could both belong. So I talked about how awkward it's been, at least initially, in a new church, kind of coming in when you are the only person in your marriage attending, with like single parent feeling, with little kids, trying to meet people and make connections. And what I realized was pretty soon after attending this American Baptist church was that there was another couple that we knew of, I didn't know of well, but who also was in an agnostic Christian marriage. And so it was actually Josh's idea, like, well, why don't we hang out with them? Like, they're in the same situation. Like, why don't we get together? Yeah. And at that time, it was the same time that our church was really pushing like small group ministries and stuff. And so they were putting a call out, like, if you have an idea for a small group, bring it forward. And so I don't think they were expecting it, but to their credit, they've been so wonderful about it. So we got together and we said, well, what if we just put a call out and see if there's any other couples? Cause it's not like we really knew. And it turned out there was like three other couples who were like, yes, we are navigating this dynamic in our marriage and we want to talk about it. So we started meeting, I guess it was like a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago now. once a month, and we get together and we share a meal. And we've gone through different things together. Like we did something called the Interfaith Family Journal together. But usually we just kind of get together and just talk. And a lot of times we'll talk about rituals in our interfaith homes, or things like, how do we talk to our kids about X, Y, Z? And it's just been a really generative place for us. A place where, yeah, we feel totally at home because we're represented in the demographic. And actually, it's been really cool. After publishing the book, my church has asked me to, you know, I spoke at our first, or the first outdoor service that I attended this last month. They asked me to come and talk about the book, and they're going to do like a little outdoor book discussion featuring the different interfaith families that are in our small group, and trying to bring those stories kind of to the forefront of church conversation. So that's been really, really awesome, just to feel that welcome and that inclusion, because it doesn't always happen that these stories kind of come to the center. They're usually more on the fringes. So that's been really wonderful.
Yeah, and how cool too, because I think the first thing that people feel the loss of is the loss of that church community. Because oftentimes, like, you know, I even remember the last church I attended regularly, you know, the first thing that I started to miss was just my interaction with, you know, the people that I had become friends with every single Sunday, or, you know, the off weekdays, you know, things. But yeah, so start your own. That's fantastic. I love that. And that made me think of one last question I had to ask you, just because I forgot, and I thought this was really neat in the book. You picked up this really cool prayer practice, I believe, and I'm probably going to mispronounce this, but examine, is that right?
Yep, no, that's right.
So yeah, talk about that and how it extended for you into something that's become a really useful practice in your marriage, even aside from like the religious aspect to it, and kind of how you used it within your marriage.
Yeah, so this is an Ignatian spiritual exercise, and St. Ignatius has this like really intense like spiritual exercises program that you can do. I think it's a whole month long. So you can do the hard route with St. Ignatius, or he says that the most important prayer, if you forego all the other prayers, is to do the examine prayer. So it's kind of the shortcut prayer, but it's a way to kind of take stock. Either you can do it several times during a day, you can do it once a day, you can do it once a month. You know, it can be at any point in any kind of increment of time, but it's a point of just reflection of, where did I see God today? And God can be, where did I see love? Where did I see wholeness? Where did I see beauty? Where did I see health and thriving and flourishing? You know, where did I see that in my day or week or month or whatever it is? And identifying that, so taking some time to identify that, and then asking, you know, the flip side of that, where did I not see God today? Where did I experience hate, fear, death, destruction? And you look back over your day and kind of identify that moment. And for Josh and I, you know, we don't do this super regularly, but it has been a practice that I feel like is friendly towards, you know, Christians, non-Christians. Anyone can do it. You don't have to necessarily pray. Like, there is like an opening part of the prayer where you invite the Holy Spirit to come. And then at the end part of the prayer, you can, you know, offer up the things that were, you know, the negative things of the day, and ask for more of the positive things. You don't necessarily have to do that prayer part, but you can still do the naming of, you know, the good and the naming of the bad. And it's a way to kind of, yeah, get a sense for, well, where did I see movement in my life that I want more of, and where did I see things that I don't want more of? And so for us, it's a way for us just to check in with each other. So I'm actually hearing if something significant did happen in Josh's day, that there's a time for us to actually talk about it after putting the kids to bed and washing the dishes and what have you. But it's also can over time, if you're noticing, oh, every day, the best part of my day is my walk outside, or every day, the worst part of my day is this email that I have to write, or, you know, whatever it might be, then you can start to identify certain trends and think, oh, maybe this is also a way of discerning. Because I think what God wants for us is more love and flourishing and beauty and truth. and less of the negative things in life. And so it can also be a way to say, oh, maybe I need to let go of this thing that is just hurting me. Or maybe this is something that I need to invest more in because this is the best part of my day. I need to go on more walks. I need to read more poetry. I need to have more conversations with my neighbor, whatever it might be that causes flourishing. And so, yeah, Josh and I have found that that's been really just good for us as a spiritual practice that feels, you know, good to both of us. And it's also something we can do with our kids. And, you know, you can call it a high, your high and your low for the day. You know, it doesn't have to be fancy. Or sometimes we call it your rose, your thorn, and your bud being the thing that you're looking forward to happening in the day ahead. And it's just, yeah, it's just been a really sweet little practice that helps us all kind of stay connected to each other.
Well, I love that. And I think that is the perfect spot to end. So,
Great. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on. Like I said, I can't recommend the book enough. You know, it's finally time that there's something out there that, that addresses this subject, and what a beautifully written book. So Blessed Are the Nuns, Mixed Faith Marriage and My Search for Spiritual Community by Stina Kielsmeyer Cook. Fantastic book. And yeah, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate this. This is a really fun conversation.
Well, it was really great to be here. Thanks so much for your thoughtful questions. Where the company line was the only way to get paid. We built a church on certainty that fears everything against it. Where the refugee suffers and
taking me too long to recover.
take a while to wade through the fear and the hurt. But I think there's a way for us to love and heal the world.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.